All right, so get this. Imagine loaning millions in securities to a business that's, about to go belly up.
Right.
You're taking a hefty chunk of their profits, but you insist you're not a partner.
Yeah.
Then, surprise, a creditor comes knocking, saying, "Nope, you are liable." That's the drama of Martin v. Payton, a 1927 New York case that's still shaping partnership law even today.
What's fascinating about this case, I think, is how the court had to like dissect this whole tangled web of this loan
Yes,
agreement,
Juna.
profit sharing, and all these lender protections to figure out
Right,
if
right.
these guys were truly partners or just some really savvy lenders
Right.
just trying to protect their investment.
It makes you wonder, where's the line between being a helpful lender and then, whoops,
Right.
you're accidentally a partner with all the liabilities?
Don't
And
expect.
how does this, almost 100-year-old case even affect deals being made right now?
Good question.
So let's deep dive into Martin v. Payton and find out.
Let's do it. So, to set the stage, picture this. It's the early 1920s. Financial markets are still kind of recovering from World War I. Our main player is this brokerage firm, Knopf, Natchett, and Kuhn. We'll call them K&K for short.
Yeah.
And they are on the verge of collapse. Enter our potential rescuers, Payton, Perkins, and Freeman. They come in with a hefty loan, $2.5 million of liquid securities.
Now, hold on, liquid securities.
Yeah.
What is that?
Think of it as assets that can be easily converted to cash, like stocks and bonds.
Gotcha.
That gave K&K the flexibility they needed, right? They're in trouble. They needed to move quickly. But, and here's where things get interesting, the lenders weren't just doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. They also wanted a 40% share
Whoa.
of K&K's profit
Okay, 40%.
until the loan was repaid.
That sounds like a pretty big thank you for the help.
Right.
Didn't they get some say in how K&K ran their business too?
Yeah, they did. So the agreement had some unusual elements. For example, it gave these lenders veto power over any kind of trades that they considered too risky.
Interesting.
They had access to K&K's books,
Yeah.
and K&K even had to consult with them on major business decisions.
So I mean like someone looking at that would say, "Wait a minute, that's a partnership."
You could totally see that, right? Like, how is that not a partnership? It definitely raises some red flags.
Right. So how did the court address that?
Well, that's where this whole multi-factor test that the court used comes in.
Okay.
They didn't just focus on profit sharing, which, yeah, can be a red flag,
Yeah.
but they really meticulously went through the specifics of the agreement.
Okay.
So first, they looked at the intent of the parties,
Right.
that they actually want to be partners.
And the agreement, explicitly said they didn't want to be partners.
Exactly. The agreement very clearly denied any intention of forming a partnership. And the court, they paid attention to that. And then they looked at, okay, well, what kind of control did the lenders actually have? Could they actually run the business, initiate deals? Could they like bind the firm in any way?
And from what you said, it sounds like no, but could you elaborate on that a little? How did the court distinguish oversight from actual control?
Yeah.
I feel like that's going to be really important for our listeners who are drafting these kinds of agreements today.
Absolutely. So the court basically recognized that these rights that the lenders had were really primarily about protecting their investment,
Okay.
not dictating K&K's operation. Think of it like modern day lender covenants.
Okay.
So, like a bank might require some board observers if a company is going through restructuring.
Right.
That doesn't make them partners in the company. They're
Right.
just there to monitor,
Right.
not manage. So the court drew this very careful line.
So vetoing a disastrous trade is okay,
Yes.
but hiring and firing employees is nope.
That's a step too far. Exactly. They made that distinction very clear.
Okay, yeah, I'm starting to see the nuances here.
Yeah.
But what of that 40% though? I mean, 40% profit share still seems.
It's a lot, right?
Yes, it's a lot.
Yeah, it was definitely a point of scrutiny,
Yeah.
but the court viewed it more like debt compensation, not a classic partnership distribution. And remember, there were also caps on the returns.
Right.
So they had a minimum of $100,000 and a maximum of $500,000 per year. If it was a true partnership, they'd be entitled to share in all the profits and potentially even the losses.
Right.
So it's kind of like saying, look, we'll lend you a lifeline here, but we're not diving headfirst into this whole profit pool.
Right, like we want the reward, but not the risk.
Exactly.
So, I mean, were there any other really crucial factors that the court considered?
Yeah, so a big one was a limitation on the lender's risk. They were only liable for the initial loan amount, not for any other debts that K&K might accrue beyond that. Unlike partners, you know, partners face unlimited liability.
Right.
These lenders, they basically said, we'll lend you the money, but we're not jumping in the deep end with you.
Clever. But did it hold up in court?
It did. So after looking at all these factors, the court delivered their verdict. No partnership. They were lenders, not partners, and therefore not liable for K&K's debts.
Wow. So even though it had some elements that looked like a partnership, they totally saw through that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big win for the lenders.
It was a significant victory for the lenders. And it wasn't just like, oh, you're either a partner or you're not.
Right.
It really hinged on like how the court looked at all these tiny details,
okay.
The intent, the control, how the profit sharing was structured. And this leads us to the legacy of Martin v. Payton.
Yeah. Tell me, like, why is this case still making waves almost 100 years later?
Well, because it set a precedent that's relevant even today.
Okay.
It showed that courts aren't just going to look at profit sharing and be like, oh, profit sharing partnership done.
Right.
They're going to look deeper.
So for lawyers who are drafting these types of agreements now, what are the key takeaways?
Well, I think first and foremost, making sure that you explicitly disclaim partnership intent.
Okay.
Putting it in writing is crucial.
Okay, cover your bases.
Yeah, you want it to be very clear that the parties involved are not intending to create a partnership.
Gotcha. What else?
So another thing is distinguishing oversight rights from managerial control.
Okay, yeah.
And this can be really tricky.
Yeah.
Because lenders, they want some safeguards, right? Okay. They want to be able to say, hey, I don't want you to make this decision, or I want to look at your books.
Right.
But how far can they go?
Yeah, where's the line? How did Martin v. Payton clarify that?
So Martin v. Payton showed that these safeguards shouldn't cross the line into running the business.
Okay.
The lenders in that case, they had some oversight, but they couldn't actually make day-to-day decisions.
Gotcha.
Like they couldn't say who K&K hired or fired.
So vetoing a risky investment, okay. But like controlling personnel, no way.
Exactly. So it's like staying in your lane, right?
I like that. Stay in your lane.
You're there to protect your investment, not to steer the ship.
Okay. Guardrails, not steering wheel.
Exactly.
Love it.
And the last thing that I think is really important is structuring profit sharing to look more like debt compensation.
Okay. Right. Like we were talking about with Martin v. Payton.
Exactly. Right. So if it looks more like interest payments on a loan with clear caps and limits, then it's less likely to be viewed as a partnership distribution.
Okay, so limited upside, no sharing in that.
Yeah.
Okay. This is almost a century old case. Like, why should our listeners care?
Because the principles in this case are timeless.
Okay.
They provide a framework for looking at these really complicated business arrangements and making sure you're not going to end up in hot water, legally speaking.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if it's a loan agreement or a venture capital deal or even a revenue sharing arrangement. These principles apply.
Yeah, it's like a legal blueprint for making sure you don't accidentally create a partnership when you're trying to avoid it.
Exactly. And there have been other cases since Martin v. Payton that have built on these principles.
Oh, really? So, like, are there any, like, more modern rulings that we should be aware of?
Yeah. So there's this case in Repark, which was decided in 2020, and it dealt with a lender who seemed to have even more control than the lenders in Martin v. Payton.
Oh, wow.
They had these really extensive reporting rights. They had veto power on all kinds of business decisions.
So, like, almost a case that could have, like, weakened Martin v. Payton.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
Wow.
But it didn't. The court in Repark really carefully applied the Martin v. Payton framework.
Yeah.
And they said that even though this lender seems like they have all these rights, their primary role is still to protect their investment, not to actually manage the company.
So Martin v. Payton has stood the test of time, even when, like, lenders have more.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I have another question about Martin v. Payton. You mentioned that the defendants had this option to buy into K&K later on.
Mm-hmm.
Did the court, like, address what would have happened if they had done that?
Right.
Would they have been liable then?
That's a great question. And, you know, it gets to this question of what's the difference between a partnership now and a potential partnership in the future?
Right.
And just having the option to become a partner doesn't make you a partner.
Gotcha.
It depends on the timing and the specifics of the agreement.
Okay.
And in Martin v. Payton, the option to purchase that interest was separate from the loan agreement. It was a possibility, not a certainty. And the court recognized that.
So even if they eventually became partners, they wouldn't have been liable for those debts when they were just lenders.
Right, exactly. Relationships can change, you know.
Okay, that makes sense.
And courts are very careful to say, okay, when did this liability happen and what was the relationship at that time?
Okay, I think I'm starting to, like, wrap my head around this.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's say, like, just for fun, that instead of a profit-sharing arrangement, they had demanded equity.
Ooh.
Right from the start.
Interesting.
Would that have changed things?
Yeah, that introduces a whole new wrinkle. So usually when you have equity in a company, that comes with certain rights and responsibilities that are more typical of partners.
Yeah.
Like voting on major decisions.
And you're sharing in both profits and losses, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that feels more partnery.
Right. So even if they had limited control, the fact that they owned a piece of the company that could have made them look more like partners.
So the takeaway is, like, choosing between profit sharing and equity has a lot of legal consequences.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, we've talked a lot about Martin v. Payton, its impact.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I have, like, one final question.
Okay. Shoot.
So we've said profit sharing alone isn't a partnership. Equity is a stronger indicator. But where does revenue sharing fit in?
Ooh, good question. Revenue sharing, that's an interesting one. So you see revenue sharing in joint ventures, strategic alliances, franchise agreements, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And it can be structured in so many different ways.
Right.
It's kind of a gray area when it comes to partnerships.
Okay, so no easy answers.
No, not really. So, like with the other things we talked about, courts are going to look at everything to decide if it's a partnership. The intent, the level of control,
okay,
whether they share losses, the whole purpose of the agreement, the whole picture.
Okay, so it's not just, hey, we're sharing revenue, done.
Yeah, exactly. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
The digital economy, the sharing economy,
right,
all these new business models, that's pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
Think about, like, Uber, Airbnb.
Right, yeah.
They connect service providers with customers, and then they take a cut.
But are those providers partners?
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah,
and honestly, the answer is it depends.
Lawyers.
Yeah, I know, right? Courts are still figuring out how to apply these old partnership principles to these new business models.
It's like trying to, like, fit a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so what are some things they're considering?
So they're going to look at the level of control that the platform has over the providers.
Yeah.
What do those terms of service agreements say?
Right.
Are the providers independent contractors or employees?
Yeah.
What are the economics of the whole relationship really look like?
So many things to think about.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So, like, what should our listeners who are trying to navigate all of this, what's the most important takeaway?
Proceed with caution.
Okay.
Revenue sharing agreements, they can be great,
mm-hmm,
but you have to understand what they might mean. Legally speaking,
don't just assume you're good
because
you didn't use the word partnership.
Exactly. And remember, things change legally speaking. Martin v. Payton is a great foundation, but it's important to stay informed about how these principles are being applied to, like, all these new business models.
All right. I think we've reached peak legal geekery for today.
I think so.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Martin v. Payton.
Yeah, this was fun.
And, you know, how it's still relevant in the 21st century.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, whether you're dealing with profit sharing, equity, revenue sharing, whatever, always remember Martin v. Payton.
Mm-hmm.
Intent matters, control matters, and make sure your agreements are crystal clear.
That'll save you lots of legal headaches.
Exactly.
It's like we've only just started to see, like, how much Martin v. Payton is still influencing how agreements are made today.
Right, exactly.
So what's the big picture takeaway for our listeners, you know, especially those working on these crazy deals?
I think the big thing is that Martin v. Payton gives us a framework
for
how to analyze these situations.
Okay.
And it reminds us that even little details, seemingly little details, can have a huge impact.
When you're trying to figure out if someone is liable as a partner,
like
the specific wording of the contract, the level of control, those nuances can make all the difference.
It's like one of those choose your own adventure books.
Totally.
Where you make like one little decision and you end up on a completely different path.
Exactly. Exactly. And the outcome
Right.
could be totally different depending on the choices you make.
Yeah.
Martin V. Peyton is a must-read for anyone structuring deals.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about profit sharing or any kind of complex control mechanisms.
Right.
And even though it's almost a century old, the principles are so relevant.
It's like the message is read the case, understand it,
yeah,
and get good legal advice.
Yes. Don't rely on assumptions or just shaking hands and hoping for the best.
Right.
Because things are always changing.
Yeah.
We were talking about Henry Park earlier.
Right.
That shows how courts are dealing with these issues now.
Mm. With all these modern business practices, what worked back then might not work now.
Gotcha.
So you have to stay informed.
Okay, I have one final thought.
Okay.
So we talk about how the sharing economy, platform businesses.
Oh, yeah.
They're like pushing the boundaries of what we think of as a partnership.
They are.
So how does Martin E. Peyton play into those discussions?
That's a great question. It's really interesting because the principles are still relevant,
okay,
but now we have these whole new business models.
Right.
So courts are asking, do these platform providers have enough control over those who provide the services,
right,
to be considered partners?
Right.
Are those providers really independent or are they basically employees?
Oh, yeah.
It gets very tricky.
Yeah. So it's like we're trying to take Martin V. Peyton,
yeah,
and squeeze it into this like totally new world.
Exactly. Exactly.
I bet we're going to see a lot more lawsuits about this stuff as all this like internet stuff keeps growing.
Oh, absolutely. As tech keeps changing things up, the lines are going to get more and more blurred.
Yeah.
Between lenders, investors, partners, service providers, and cases like Martin V. Peyton are going to be the basis for those legal fights.
Okay.
But we're going to need some creative lawyers,
right,
to apply those ideas,
right,
to this new digital age.
So, listeners, if you're a lawyer and you love tech, this is your time to shine.
Yeah, this is it.
The future of partnership law is being written right now.
It is.
And it starts with understanding the basics from Martin V. Peyton.
Very well said. And, you know, we'll leave everyone with this question to think about.
Okay.
So AI, right? Artificial intelligence,
right,
automation, that's becoming more common in businesses.
Yeah.
So how are those relationships going to be looked at?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Under partnership law. Are AI systems partners? Do algorithms have liability? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, that's crazy.
The possibilities are endless.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you for taking us on this journey through partnership law.
Of course, it's been a pleasure.
From, you know, its history all the way to like these crazy what ifs about the future.
Yeah, it's been fun.
We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the world of legal precedent.
Sounds good.